chapter 24, assault upon the monks, and banishment of their superiors, who exhibit miraculous power. The Emperor Valens having issued an edict commanding that the Orthodox should be persecuted both in Alexandria and in the test of Egypt, depopulation and ruin to an immense extent immediately followed. Some were dragged before the tribunals, others cast into prison, and many tortured in various ways, and in fact all sorts of punishments were inflicted upon persons who aimed only at peace and quiet. When these outrages had been perpetrated at Alexandria just as Lucius thought proper, Uzoas returned to Antioch, and Lucian the Arian, attended by the commander-in-chief of the army with a considerable body of troops, immediately proceeded to the monasteries of Egypt, where the general in person assailed the assemblage of holy men with greater fury even than the ruthless soldiery. On reaching these solitudes they found the monks engaged in their customary exercises, praying, healing diseases, and casting out devils. Yet they, regardless of these extraordinary evidences of divine power, suffered them not to continue their solemn devotions, but drove them out of the oratories by force. Rufinus declares that he was not only a witness of these cruelties, but also one of the sufferers. Thus in them were renewed those things which are spoken of by the apostle: one, for they were mocked, and had trial of scourgings, were stripped naked, put in bonds, stoned, slain with the sword, went about in the wilderness clad in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts, in mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. In all these things they obtained a good report for their faith and their works, and the cures which the grace of Christ wrought by their hands. But as it appears divine providence permitted them to endure these evils, having for them provided something better, to that through their sufferings others might obtain the salvation of God, and this subsequent events seem to prove. When therefore these wonderful men proved superior to all the violence which was exercised toward them, Lucius in despair advised the military chief to send the fathers of the monks into exile. These were the Egyptian Macarius, and his namesake of Alexandria, both of whom were accordingly banished to an island where there was no Christian inhabitant, and in this island there was an idolatrous temple, and a priest whom the inhabitants worshipped as a god. On the arrival of these holy men at the island, the demons of that place were filled with fear and trepidation. Now it happened at the same time that the priest's daughter became suddenly possessed by a demon, and began to act with great fury, and to overturn everything that came in her way, nor was any force sufficient to restrain her, but she cried with a loud voice to these saints of God, saying, "Dash, why are ye come here to cast us out from hence also?" 3. Then did the men there also display the peculiar power which they had received through divine grace, for having eased out the demon from the maid, and presented her cured to her father, they led the priest himself, and also all the inhabitants of the island to the Christian faith, whereupon they immediately break their images in pieces, and changed the form of their temple into that of a church. And having been baptized, they joyfully received instruction in the doctrines of Christianity. Thus these marvelous individuals, after enduring persecution on account of the Homoousian faith, were themselves more approved, became the means of salvation to others, and confirmed the truth. Chapter 25, of Didymus the Blind Man. 1. About the same period God brought into observation another faithful person, deeming it worthy that through him faith might be witnessed unto. This was Didymus, a most admirable and eloquent man, instructed in all the learning of the age in which he flourished. At a very early age, when he had scarcely acquired the first elements of learning, he was attacked by disease in the eyes which deprived him of sight, but God compensated to him the loss of corporeal vision, by bestowing increased intellectual acumen. For what he could not learn by seeing, he was enabled to acquire through the sense of hearing, so that being from his childhood endowed with excellent abilities, he soon far surpassed his youthful companions who possessed the keenest sight. He made himself master of the principles of grammar and rhetoric with astonishing facility, and proceeded thence to philosophical studies, dialectics, arithmetic, music, and the various other departments of knowledge to which his attention was directed, and he so treasured up in his mind these branches of science, that he was prepared with the utmost readiness to enter into a discussion of these subjects with those who had become conversant therewith by reading books. Not only this, but he was so well acquainted with the divine oracles contained in the Old and New Testament that he composed several treatises in exposition of them. Besides three books on the Trinity, he published also commentaries to on Origen's Book of Principles, in which he commends these writings, saying that they are excellent, and that those who calumniate their author, and speak slightingly of his works, are mere cavillers, for, says he, they are destitute of sufficient penetration to comprehend the profound wisdom of that extraordinary man. Those who may desire to form a just idea of the extensive erudition of Didymus, and the intense ardor of his mind, must peruse with attention his diversified and elaborate works. It is said that after Antony had conversed for some time with this Didymus, long before the reign of Valens, when he came from the desert to Alexandria on account of the Arians, perceiving the learning and intelligence of the man, he said to Hyer, "Didymus, let not the loss of your bodily eyes distress you, for you are deprived of such eyes merely as are the common possession of gnats and flies. Rather rejoice that you have eyes such as angels see with, by which the Deity himself is discerned, and his light comprehended." This address of the pious Antony to Didymus was made long before the times we are describing. In fact, Didymus was then regarded as the great bulwark of the true faith, answering the Arians, whose sophistic cavillings he fully exposed, triumphantly refuting all their vain subtleties and deceptive reasonings. Chapter 26, of Basil of Caesarea, and Gregory of Nazianzus. 1. Now Providence supposed Didymus to the Arians at Alexandria, but for the purpose of confuting them in other cities, it raised up Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nazianzus. Concerning these it will be reasonable to give a brief account in this place. Indeed, the universally prevalent memory of the men would be enough as a token of their fame, and the extent of their knowledge is sufficiently perceptible in their writings. Since, however, the exercise of their talents was of great service to the Church, tending in a high degree to the maintenance of the Catholic faith, the nature of my history obliges me to take particular notice of these two persons. If anyone should compare Basil and Gregory with one another, and consider the life, morals, and virtues of each, he would find it difficult to decide to which of them he ought to assign the preeminence, so equally did they both appear to excel, whether you regard the rectitude of their conduct, or their deep acquaintance with Greek literature and the sacred scriptures. In their youth they were pupils at Athens of Himerius II and Proheresius, three the most celebrated sophists of that age. Subsequently they frequented the school of Libanius IV at Antioch in Syria, where they cultivated rhetoric to the utmost. Having been deemed worthy of the profession of sophistry, they were urged by many of their friends to enter the profession of teaching eloquence. Others would have persuaded them to practice law, but despising both these pursuits, they abandoned their former studies, and embraced the monastic life. Having had some slight taste of philosophical science from him who then taught it at Antioch, they procured Origen's works, and drew from them the right interpretation of the sacred scriptures, for the fame of Origen was very great and widespread throughout the whole world at that time. After a careful perusal of the writings of that great man, they contended against the Arians with manifest advantage. And when the defenders of Arianism quoted the same author in confirmation, as they imagined, of their own views, these two confuted them, and clearly proved that their opponents did not at all understand the reasoning of Origen. Indeed, although Eunomius, V, who was then their champion, and many others on the side of the Arians were considered men of great eloquence, yet whenever they attempted to enter into controversy with Gregory and Basil, they appeared in comparison with them ignorant and illiterate. Basil, being ordained to the office of deacon, was by Meletius, bishop of Antioch, from that rank elevated to the bishopric of Caesarea in Cappadocia, which was his native country. Thither he therefore hastened, fearing lest these Arian dogmas should have infected the provinces of Pontus, and in order to counteract them, he founded several monasteries, diligently instructed the people in his own doctrines, and confirmed the faith of those whose minds were wavering. Gregory being constituted bishop of Nazianzus, Six, a small city of Cappadocia over which his own father had before presided, pursued a course similar to that which Basil took, for he went through the various cities, and strengthened the weak in faith. To Constantinople in particular he made frequent visits, and by his ministrations there, comforted and assured the Orthodox believers, wherefore a short time after, by the suffrage of many bishops, he was made bishop of the church at Constantinople. When intelligence of the proceedings of these two zealous and devoted men reached the ears of the emperor Valens, he immediately ordered Basil to be brought from Caesarea to Antioch, 7, where being arraigned before the tribunal of the prefect, that functionary asked him why he would not embrace the emperor's faith. Basil with much boldness condemned the errors of that creed which his sovereign countenanced, and vindicated the doctrine of the Homoousion, and when the prefect threatened him with death, would, said Basil, that I might be released from the bonds of the body for the truth's sake. The prefect having exhorted him to reconsider the matter more seriously, Basil is reported to have said, I am the same today that I shall be tomorrow, but I wish that you had not changed yourself. At that time, therefore, Basil remained in custody throughout the day. It happened, however, not long afterwards that Galates, the emperor's infant son, was attacked with a dangerous malady, so that the physicians despaired of his recovery, when the Empress Dominica, his mother, assured the emperor that she had been greatly disquieted in her dreams by fearful visions, which led her to believe that the child's illness was a chastisement on account of the ill treatment of the bishop. The emperor, after a little reflection, sent for Basil, and in order to prove his faith said to him, if the doctrine you maintain is the truth, pray that my son may not die. If your majesty should believe as I do, replied Basil, and the church should be unified, the child shall live. To these conditions the emperor would not agree. God's will concerning the child will be done then, said Basil. As Basil said this, the emperor ordered him to be dismissed. The child, however, died shortly after. Such is an epitome of the history of these distinguished ecclesiastics, both of whom have left us many admirable works, some of which Rufinus says he has translated into Latin. Basil had two brothers, Peter and Gregory, the former of whom adopted Basil's monastic mode of life, while the latter emulated his eloquence in teaching, and completed after his death Basil's treatise on the 6 days' work, which had been left unfinished. He also pronounced at Constantinople the funeral oration of Meletius, bishop of Antioch, and many other orations of his are still extant. Chapter 27, of Gregory Thaumaturgus the Wonder Worker. But since from the likeness of the name, and the title of the books attributed to Gregory, persons are liable to confound very different parties, it is important to notice that Gregory of Pontus is a different person. He was a native of Neo-Caesarea in Pontus, of greater antiquity than the one above referred to, inasmuch as he was a disciple of Origen. One, this Gregory's fame was celebrated at Athens, at Berytus, throughout the entire diocese of Pontus, and I might almost add in the whole world. When he had finished his education in the schools of Athens, he went to Berytus to study civil law, where hearing that Origen expounded the holy scriptures at Caesarea, he quickly proceeded thither, and after his understanding had been opened to perceive the grandeur of these divine books, bidding adieu to all further cultivation of the Roman laws, he became thenceforth inseparable from Origen, from whom having acquired a knowledge of the true philosophy, he was recalled soon after by his parents and returned to his own country, and there, while still a layman, he performed many miracles, healing the sick, and casting out devils even by his letters, insomuch that the pagans were no less attracted to the faith by his acts than by his discourses. Pamphilus Martyr mentions this person in the books which he wrote in defense of Origen, to which there is added a commendatory oration of Gregory's, composed in praise of Origen, when he was under the necessity of leaving him. There were then, to be brief, several Gregories. The first and most ancient was the disciple of Origen, the second was the bishop of Nazianzus, the third was Basil's brother, And there was another Gregory, to whom the Arians constituted bishop during the exile of Athanasius. But enough has been said respecting them. Chapter 28, of Navatus and his followers. The Navatians of Phrygia alter the time of keeping Easter, following Jewish usage. About this time the Novatians, one inhabiting Phrygia, changed the day for celebrating the feast of Easter. How this happened I shall state, after first explaining the reason of the strict discipline which is maintained in their church, even to the present day, in the provinces of Phrygia and Paphlagonia. Novatus, to a presbyter of the Roman Church, separated from it, because Cornelius the bishop received into communion believers who had sacrificed during the persecution which the emperor Decius III had raised against the church. Having seceded on this account, on being afterwards elevated to the episcopacy by such bishops as entertained similar sentiments, he wrote to all the churches for that they should not admit to the sacred mysteries those who had sacrificed, but exhorting them to repentance, leave the pardoning of their offense to God, who has the power to forgive all sin. Receiving such letters, the parties in the various provinces, to whom they were addressed, acted according to their several dispositions and judgments. As he asked that they should not receive to the sacraments those who after baptism had committed any deadly sin. 5. This appeared to some a cruel and merciless course, but others received the rule as just and conducive to the maintenance of discipline, and the promotion of greater devotedness of life. In the midst of the agitation of this question, letters arrived from Cornelius the bishop, promising indulgence to delinquents after baptism. Thus, as these two persons wrote contrary to one another, and each confirmed his own procedure by the testimony of the divine word, as it usually happens, every one identified himself with that view which favored his previous habits and inclinations. Those who had pleasure in sin, encouraged by the license then granted them, took occasion from it to revel in every species of criminality. Now the Phrygians appear to be more temperate than other nations, and are seldom guilty of swearing. The Scythians, on the other hand, and the Thracians, are naturally of a very irritable disposition, while the inhabitants of the East are addicted to sensual pleasures. But the Paphlagonians and Phrygians are prone to neither of these vices, nor are the sports of the circus and theatrical exhibitions in much estimation among them even to the present day. And for this reason, it seems to me, these people, as well as others of the same character, so readily assented to the letters then written by Novatus. Fornication and adultery are regarded among them as the grossest enormities, and it is well known that there is no race of men on the face of the earth who more rigidly govern their passions in this respect than the Phrygians and Paphlagonians. The same reason I think had force with those who dwelt in the West and followed Novatus. Yet although for the sake of stricter discipline Novatus became a separatist, he made no change in the time of keeping Easter. 6. But invariably observed the practice that obtained in the Western churches, for they celebrate this feast after the equinox, according to the usage which had of old been delivered to them when first they embraced Christianity. He himself indeed afterwards suffered martyrdom in the reign of Valerian, 7. During the persecution which was then raised against the Christians. But those in Phrygia 8 who are named after him Novatians, about this period changed the day of celebrating Easter, being averse to communion with other Christians even on this occasion. This was effected by means of a few obscure bishops of that sect convening a synod at the village of Pisum, which is situated near the sources of the river Sangarius, for that they framed a canon appointing its observance on the same day as that on which the Jews annually keep the feast of unleavened bread. An aged man, who was the son of a presbyter, and had been present with his father at this synod, gave us our information on this matter. But both Agellius, bishop of the Novatians at Constantinople, and Maximus of Nicaea, as also the bishops of Nicomedia and Gotium, were absent. Although the ecclesiastical affairs of the Novatians were for the most part under the control of these bishops. How the Church of the Novatians soon after was divided into two parties in consequence of this synod, shall be related in its proper course. 9. But we must now notice what took place about the same time in the western parts. Chapter 29. Damasus ordained bishop of Rome. Sedition and loss of life caused by the rivalry Ursinus. While the emperor Valentinian governed in peace, and interfered with no sect. Damasus, after Liberius, undertook the administration of the bishopric at Rome, one whereupon a great disturbance was caused on the following account. To a certain Ursinus, a deacon of that church, had been nominated among others when the election of a bishop took place, as Damasus was preferred. This Ursinus, unable to bear the disappointment of his hopes, held schismatic assemblies apart from the church, and even induced certain bishops of little distinction to ordain him in secret. This ordination was made, not in a church, but in a retired place called the Palace of Sison, whereupon dissension arose among the people, their disagreement being not about any article of faith or heresy, but simply as to who should be bishop. Hence frequent conflicts arose, insomuch that lives were sacrificed in this contention, and many of the clergy as well as laity were punished on that account by Maximin, the prefect of the city. Thus was Ursinus obliged to desist from his pretensions at that time, and those who were minded to follow him were reduced to order. Chapter 30. Dissension about a successor to Auxentius, bishop of Milan. Ambrose, governor of the province, going to appease the tumult, is by general consent and with the approval of the emperor Valentinian elected to the bishopric of that church. About the same time it happened that one another event took place at Milan well worthy of being recorded. On the death of Auxentius, who had been ordained bishop of that church by the Arians, the people again were disturbed respecting the election of a successor, for as some proposed one person, and others favoured another, the city was full of contention and uproar. In this state of things the governor of the province, Ambrose by name, too, who was also of consular dignity, dreading some catastrophe from the popular excitement, ran into the church in order to quell the disturbance. As he arrived there and the people became quiet, he repressed the irrational fury of the multitude by a long and appropriate address, by urging such motives as they felt to be right, and all present suddenly came to an unanimous agreement, crying out that Ambrose was worthy of the bishopric, and demanding his ordination, for by that means only, it was alleged, would the peace of the church be secured, and all be reunited in the same faith and judgment. And inasmuch as such unanimity among the people appeared to the bishops then present to proceed from some divine appointment, immediately they laid hands on Ambrose, and having baptized him, for he was then but a catechumen, they were about to invest him with the episcopal office. But although Ambrose willingly received baptism, he with great earnestness refused to be ordained, upon which the bishops referred the matter to the emperor Valentinian. This prince, regarding the universal consent of the people as the work of God, sent word to the bishops to do the will of God by ordaining him, declaring that his choice was by the voice of God rather than by the votes of men. Ambrose was therefore ordained, and thus the inhabitants of Milan, who were divided among themselves, were once more restored to unity.